on to discussion of special events policies. Warren, please kick this off.
It's part of our efforts of being green. The lights do automatically go off at 10 o'clock.
Very good.
And they went back on at 10:01. What this is trying to get ahead of the curve and to make sure that we have an effective policy in place that would allow for-profit and not-for-profit groups to use the city's public streets and public properties for special events. And in going through this research that I was asked to do, we looked at all of the kind of best practices from other cities, but also looked into our own code of ordinances and recognized that in the mad dash of passing ordinances, we also have something within our code that is a basic policy that deals with events and special events and defines those within our ordinance, and that's Chapter 20, Assemblages in Public Places. And what I did in going through this research was look at the current ordinance that we had, but also look at some best practices from other places and made some recommendations to the council on some changes that I think might be necessary within this ordinance that we have for Chapter 20. And I'll go over these very briefly, being that it's 10 p.m. The recommended revisions, one is to put in some sort of guidance in dealing with levels of city support. And what this deals with is not advertising money or any kind of funds to help promote the event. What this is doing is there are certain costs that are associated with events on city services, and dealing with how do you allocate those so that if somebody comes in and they've got a massive festival and it's going to effectively regulate it, take 10 police officers, we need to assign that cost to the festival and not to the general taxpayers of the city. So this kind of organizes that level of city support, ranging from city-sponsored events, and this would be something where we either are directly providing the, putting on the festival or event, or it's so much of it in our interest that we actually go ahead and the council goes ahead and sponsors the event. That's the city co-sponsored event is really where we're going in with another organization. And then you've got the provisions for nonprofit events, for-profit events, and then other events. Mostly everything from C down, there's either a cost share or the event producer provides all of the costs. And what this comes down to is they provide within their application a plan for what they plan to do and what services they think are going to be provided. We then route that through our various departments as part of the review process. We assess what they think is going to take to run the event. We substitute our judgment in some cases after talking with the producer and from our experience, and then come up with a cost estimate to be able to run the event prior to the time that it would be issued a permit. And this kind of puts a little bit of sense into it as to, if a nonprofit comes forward and says, we want to do this event, this is wonderful for the community, we might need two officers, but we can only pay for one, would the city be willing to have an officer there? And this gives us a little bit of guidance as to how to apportion those costs. The next thing we have in the packet is the categorization of special event hazards. And this ranges from a Class 1 low risk to a Class 4 maximum risk. And this gives us a little bit of guidance for two reasons. One, it helps us ascertain level of insurance to be able to go up or down, and then also for myself to be able to assign special conditions to the issuance of the permit to be able to kind of deal with some of the higher risk activities. You've got something in a Class 1 with a block party or a wedding. We don't need to assign insurance costs to that. We don't need to be doing anything. We don't need 10 officers to guard a wedding. But when you get into maximum risk, when you're talking about fireworks displays, alcohol beverage sales, vehicle races, where there is potentially an inherent risk to the spectators or to the businesses that join that public space, it gives me the opportunity to make special conditions of the permit. The next bullet point is the elimination of zoning requirements, and I think this is just something that didn't make a whole lot of sense to us. In looking through it, it made sure that there was a community development review of zoning for a special event, but if you have a special event that's going to occur for 9 hours, and what zoning do you need for that? so it just didn't make a lot of sense. So we put in there that eliminating the requirement, and then also establishing some parking requirements. Right now, what the code says is that it needs to meet the zoning code for parking. And the zoning code is very good at saying, you know, 5 spaces for every 1,000 square feet. But again, when you have a 9-hour temporary event, how do you figure it out? So we were recommending establishing a regulation that they, you know, submit a parking plan. And the standard of the review is that, you know, that they come up with some methodology to park as many cars as reasonably possible without coming up with a set standard that would be difficult to apply across the board. The next bullet is for the process for closure of major city arteries. And what this is, just a little bit of inconsistency in the language. You've got, again, you've got one for events and one for special events. The event language is very good, and it deals with a standard of review for being overly disruptive to the flow, and that deals with two elements. One is that you can't be overly disruptive, but if you are going to be overly disruptive, then you have a plan to mitigate that so that it is not overly disruptive. So what I do is just mimic that language for both of those sections. The other thing that we've dealt with on a practical level is that it has been unclear in the code for the liquor license. We've got a fee for a temporary pouring permit for profit and not-for-profit folks, but what staff was interpreting the code to say is that we also had to charge them an application fee on top of that for a liquor license, like we would for any restaurant or business, and this would just be put something in the ordinance that provision of Chapter 4 would not apply for these type of events, because, again, if you're going to do a one-time 6-hour event, you shouldn't have to pay for an application fee for a full liquor license like we would for a regular business. Reservation of annual event dates. This is a provision we saw in a number of ordinances to add, so that if you have, you know, a date that's, you know, always the third Monday in September, that somebody can't come in and take that one from you, that you can reserve those dates up to 5 years in advance to ensure the continuity of your event, but you'd still need to apply each year and receive approval. So you wouldn't be given pre-approval, but you'd be able to reserve those dates in advance. Then we've got notification of neighboring property owner businesses, and this would be a requirement prior to the issuance of making the application for the permit. You need to show that you have gone ahead and notified these businesses so that it's not a surprise, and that those businesses then have the opportunity to come back to me and say, you know, they're going to be killing my business. They didn't make adequate plans for parking or for disruption of my business. Please deny this permit. And we've got a requirement we saw in some of the other ordinances to provide the city of Dunwoody youth space for public education and PR at no cost to the city. This gives us an opportunity if we have exciting things going on like comp plans or other programs, say for the police department to do fingerprinting, that we have the ability to go into the festival and do some things for the public good as well at no cost to the city. And we've got another one in here, the second to last bullet, is a provision for council approval of new events and unprecedented activities. And this would be at the city manager's discretion. And this is kind of for the unforeseen, things that I can't think of right now to give you as an example. I've come up with some horrible examples in my mind, like they decided to move the inauguration of the president from Washington, D.C. to Dunwoody, and they applied for a permit. What would I do with that one? I'd come to city council and say, oh my God, what the heck are we going to do here? So that is the basics of that. So it's basically it's an unprecedented activity. The size and scope falls clearly outside the scope of Chapter 20. That it doesn't fall directly on the city manager, have the discretion to bring that to council, and that would be codified. And then the last bullet point is for discussion purposes, because it was part of a previous debate on special events, is to gather whether or not anything needs to be put into the ordinance of spacing of special events to prevent the burden on city services and other considerations. And I believe that is the extent of the memorandum, so I wanted to get some feedback from council and also let you know exactly where we sit right now on what's in the code and what's outside of the code. I'd be happy to answer any questions y'all may have.
Questions for Ward? Dean?
Warren, on the item number B under levels of city service, can the city sponsor both a nonprofit and a for-profit event?
Yes. There would be no, it would be at the city council's discretion whether or not they wanted to provide financial incentive for the, in other words, if we came up with a bill for $10,000 for services and the council said we'd only like to charge them $5,000, you'd have the discretion whether that was a for-profit or not-for-profit group. But I wouldn't have that discretion to do that amount.
What's an example of the city operating special event that you mentioned, number 8?
For example, if the city at some point decided that we would take over the 4th of July parade, or we get a Memorial Day parade, and that would be the city's event, then we would be the sponsor of that event, and obviously we wouldn't be required to comply with our ordinance.
That's a terrible example.
Fireworks display, there you go. Fireworks display, Memorial Day.
How about takeover Doty Country Club's fireworks display? That would be more palatable.
Or dunk the mayor.
Yeah, that brings me to another piece of it that has to do with parking, which is something we need to make sure we handle on the fireworks display at Doty Country Club. You recommend establishing a parking regulation for special events that require a parking plan. I think that probably needs to be better defined. I'll show you some examples of that.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's a recognition that anytime you get a large-scale special event, and if somebody says, let's take 4th of July as an example, they come and say, you know, we're expecting 30,000 people, and I say, okay, where are you going to park all 30,000 vehicles, and you have to show that to me, it's not reasonable. So we've got to come up with some sort of just standard that is reasonable to the size and scope of the event. There's some kind of creative discretion involved there.
One other comment, and I'll pass it. Sorry, Robert.
That's right.
David. Notification to neighboring property owners and businesses. I'm wondering how that would happen for your example, the DHA parade, the DHA and the Crier parade. That would be near impossible.
Right. And I think the leap from going from the bullet point to the ordinance is where we cover some of those things. And, you know, you can put in when practicable, you know, different qualifiers. Because certainly, that's a great example of you'd be notifying all of Dunwoody. So it would just not be reasonable.
Sounds good. All right. Danny had a follow-up, then Robert.
Yeah. Under the reservation for annual event states, as we discussed in the last meeting, I think that we need to give some consideration for some of the events that we're sponsoring for the events in terms of the timing between these two events. And also, I think we need to develop a calendar which shows all of these events and post that calendar on the website. The Dunwoody Women's Club used to have such a calendar online. I don't know if they still do it or not, but we probably should have one on the City of Dunwoody website. And some of the events, such as the home tour that the Dunwoody Women's Club and the garden club tour that the Dunwoody Nature Center has, they don't require that, but that should still be on the calendar. They don't require a permit, but it still should be on the calendar. I've got some of these comments written down. I'd be happy to pass it on to you so you can have more definition of it. I think that, in general, you know, I think we've covered a lot of things here. I think this is the right thing to do, to put it, take it off the councilor's, agenda when we get into sponsoring these things. I think this is the proper way of doing it. I think your pleasure, Mr. Mayor, was correct, and I salute that. In general, I think that the city probably should not partner with a for-profit organization, but obtain that certainly for non-profit organizations.
Robert?
I have just a few specific questions. First of all, very nice job. Thank you. I thought this was great, and it was exactly what we needed. So great job there. Thank you. My first question was, you talked about levels of city support, city-sponsored event, city-co-sponsored event, nonprofit event, for-profit events, etc. My assumption was, although it wasn't stated in here, that would be that would be the city council's decision to make.
Yes.
Right, so that's not something that you could decide that we were going to be co-sponsors of. All of those decisions would come to us.
Yeah, and I think it's specified in
Did I miss it?
B, it says the city council may co-sponsor certain events.
Got it, okay.
So that is the intent.
Right. No, good. On the categorization, low, moderate, high risk, there were a couple that seemed a little out of place to me.
Okay.
So I would suggest that festivals and craft shows aren't a high risk thing. They're perhaps moderate risk, and the same for sidewalk sales. Those didn't seem like you could... They would go in the same thing as major sporting events and marathons.
Okay.
So
we can take a look at it. I think the thought process is that on the class 3 high risk, it just deals with the amount of people that you're expecting into the area, not necessarily the danger of, you know, flying crafts or anything like that hitting you. But the if you're going to put 10,000 people in a small space, you may want to put some special conditions on it. It's not a matter of whether they can get the permit to conduct the event. What this does is really protects the city, because it gives me some discretion to be able to say on a class 3 or 4 event, I can start to create special conditions that don't currently exist in the code, but they make more sense because you've got a higher risk.
Okay. I'll take that.
Well, we'll take a look at that.
But the follow-up on that is, I'd like us to... For low-risk Class 1 events, I'd like us to either not require or give you discretion to waive the requirement for insurance. I want people to feel like they have to come for the permit, but I don't want them not to come for that picnic permit or that block party permit, because you're going to require that you show that they've got insurance. So for the lowest risk level, let's remove the barriers from having them come by not requiring something that a block party or a picnic is not going to have. They're not going to be able to show evidence of insurance. Let's not have them.
No problem.
Do that.
John,
maybe
we have class 1 and class 2. I've got discretion. Yeah. Insurance.
Right, great, thank you.
The point of insurance is one that a resident has discussed with me. I'm aware of an event that happens every year here in Dunwoody with 5,000 people showing up attending one block. If they don't throw that event this year coming up because of the onus of the insurance or the paperwork or the legal liability of the police aspect that they should have on site, it's going to happen anyway. This event is a yearly event. It's going to happen. There's an aspect of it that I'm not sure this falls into the guidelines in which they can meet. There's the risk level, low, medium, or high, however you want to rank it. I'm concerned about this event going away. I could tell you what it is, but I think you already know.
I'm talking about Halloween, right?
Halloween at Briars North.
I don't need Halloween in your neighborhood.
No, Briars North. 5,000 people show up every year.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And the street is closed off, not for the stopping of traffic, but for the safety aspect of it. It's not something that the Homeowners Association anymore even recognizes to a certain extent. It's now an event that happens anyway. If they didn't say one word about it, there'd be 5,000 people there next year, no matter what. And I'm not sure how that specific event falls into this codification, because again, there's liability. No homeowner is going to sign and say that they're going to be liable for everything that happens on their street during that 3-hour period. Typically, they have a collection bucket. You throw a couple dollars in, and that pays for the off-duty police officer that might be on site. So again, I'm concerned over this specific ordinance. I understand that you can waive it. I'm just hoping that there is a way in which we do not put an existing event and we codify it out of existence.
Sure, and we can't, do any grandfathering. I don't think within the ordinance to say that anything that existed prior to this can continue year to year, but we can certainly make the requirements reasonable enough to accommodate certain events, right, such as the one you're describing.
If it's a block party.
Take a look at.
If it's a block party, then if it's level 1, then...
Yeah, we can adjust the verbiage that says less than 20 people.
As long as the liability insurance can happen, I mean, they don't officially block the street. So, again, it's, as far as the regulations that I saw, it's not really a special event if you don't block the street. So, again, it comes down to the insurance and the way in which
the
permit...
blocking the street.
Yes, right.
Yeah,
it is blocked.
Let's face it. So, just something I wanted to make sure that we looked at.
Yeah, I think we can accommodate that. That should not be a problem whatsoever.
Those are unofficial sawhorses they put up.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, thanks, John. And I've got some terrible news for you. You might not have heard, but Halloween is canceled this year. Georgia, Florida is on Halloween. So they're on Halloween.
That'll cut down on our drunks, won't it?
That won't cut down on the drunks.
Halloween, it will.
Any other questions for John? Yes, Danny. I just got a quick comment. You know, this is, we should, Ken and I should give the credit to where the credit really do, really belongs. What was that gentleman's name again? I forgot his name. Yeah, you got to go him. This is, Ken got a call from this gentleman, and then we got together and we started talking about this, and just luckily enough, we called enough people, and a young lady over in the city council in Sandy Springs, who I think I talked to you about, Robert, Diana Fries, did this in Sandy Springs because they didn't have one for the first 6 months to a year, and they were going nuts over there trying to figure this out, and it really works out. One, I commend you for doing this. I think, you know, we can always make little tweaks, but this is the way we want to go. And I think, is that the general feeling in the council there?
Yeah.
Any other comments for Warren questions? All right, Warren, so next step is
next week.
Going to tighten it up and clean it up. All right, with that, it is 10:26. The lights are due to go out at 10:30. So with that in mind, we're on public comment. Any white cards, Brian? If you've not filled out a white card and wish to speak, please make your way to the podium, sure, and just state your name.
My name is Todd Anderson. Sorry to get around, too. I know it's late. It seems like in regard to this notice requirement that maybe we have two different animals between land use, which is inherently, I think, a longer process, and especially, Mr. Taylor, it, as you said, if you get the DHA involved, I think it naturally gets publicized better. A variance is not necessarily a long process, but can have, in my mind, very detrimental effects. And this, and again, I'm using no good to us in our particular case right now, which is the Goddard School. But it'll happen again. And so it's not, this isn't for my direct benefit in this case, because we can't change it. But we can end up with a playground with 154 kids within egg-throwing distance of homes. And it's just not a good thing. And we get a notice maybe, let's call it 13 days in advance of the meeting. We were told that we should negotiate with the applicant. We were told informally by people on the Zoning Board of Appeals that we should have an attorney if we choose to fight this. So we're supposed to organize our neighborhood, negotiate with the applicant, hire an attorney, figure out, but in our case, it's a stream buffer, and there's some, it sounds like from talking to the attorney today, some somewhat technical requirements that may not have been met, and we're trying to figure that out. So it's one thing if the variance is for someone to do something very minor in their home. I guess there are different animals, is what I'm trying to say. So either, I don't know how you, it's almost like a tiering process of some sort, maybe for minor stuff versus stuff with greater ramifications. Or you say to the, you direct the Zoning Board of Appeals that it's not something that's clear cut, and someone, citizens are screaming that we haven't had time to appropriately address it, that their default is to defer it versus ruling on it. Something to give us a chance, because I think, as Mr. Nall said, they're holding all the cards. The applicant has had time to do their thing. They've thought through the process. They've worked with the city. We have 12 to 13 days to do everything that I just described. It can't happen. If it were behind your house, I hope you want more time. It's just not realistic. So my one point is that, and my second point again, that is just to reemphasize how important the zoning is, because we're having to, this could have happened, if not for the stream buffer, this would have happened to us, and we would have watched them put the equipment up. and never had any chance to find it. So, again, against residential, what I thought I was getting when I voted for the city was a more restrictive ordinance, and we're not right now. And I hope that's our intention. I don't know if it is or not, but I hope that's our intention, is to get more restrictive and at least make someone apply for a special exception or something where they're having to ask permission versus us looking up one day and finding out we're in a bad situation. So.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson. Anybody else that'd like to make public comment, please make your way to the podium. All right, seeing that there's none, I'm going to make a motion to adjourn.
Mr. Mayor, we do have an executive session item.
You do? We do. Okay, then I will rescind my motion.
And
Mr. Shortall,
motion to go to the executive session.
Second.
That was a triple tie, and I'll give it to Robert Wittstein for a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We're going to move into executive session. I guess we have a room now for executive session.
You got hot mics here.
What is the topic?